Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's special guest interviewer, Akasha Gloria Hull. An independent writer, teacher, poet, lecturer, and consultant, Akasha has been a professor of women's studies and literature at the University of California, Santa Cruz, the University of Delaware, and the University of the West Indies, Mona, in Kingston, Jamaica. She holds BA, MA, and PhD degrees, and also an honorary Doctor of Letters awarded by Purdue University for pioneering work in the field of Black feminist studies that has empowered others to hear and appreciate diverse voices. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Fulbright, Rockefeller, Mellon, and Ford Foundations, the American Association of University Women, and the National Humanities Center. She is the author of several books, and most recently, Soul Talk, The New Spirituality of African American Women, which was praised in Publishers Weekly as powerful, practical, and nourishing gumbo of the heart and spirit. Please welcome Akasha Gloria Hull.
Thank you, and good evening to everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce Octavia Butler. I have been reading Octavia Butler since 1976. I have here my original paperback edition of her first published book, Pattern Master, 1976, and her second published novel, Mind of My Mind, 1977. I pulled them off the shelf. I love these books. Now, these books, with their networks of telepathically linked human beings, lethal power struggles, and fascinating female heroines and healers, inaugurated Octavia Butler's career and inaugurated my love of her and her work. From this beginning, she has gone on to publish 12 novels and a collection of short stories entitled Blood Child and Other Stories. These 12 novels are comprised of her Patternist series, Pattern Master, Mind of My Mind, Survivor, Wild Seed, and Clay's Ark, her Xenogenesis trilogy, which includes Dawn, Adulthood Rights, and Imago, the slavery novel, Kindred, that a lot of us have read, 1979, the two parable books, Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, and now this last book, her vampire novel, Fledgling. The book of hers that stays with me as the most enduring, maybe because it was the first one I read at a particularly impressionable period in my life, is Pattern Master. The book that I consider most extraordinarily conceived and executed, and that I teach most often, is Wild Seed. I also have my first hardback edition of Wild Seed, 1980. And the book that works for me as the wisest and most thought-provoking is Parable of the Talents. It's the kind of book that makes me want to discuss and argue it with the author and other smart people. The novel that most immediately hooked me and gave me the most reading pleasure is this latest one, Fledgling, that we'll be talking predominantly about tonight. And I can't end this catalog without noting that the work of hers, which most gives me the heebie-jeebies, is her famous story, some call it a novelette, Blood Child, with its breeding larvae and pregnant men. These last two writings are why we have this treasured opportunity to be with Octavia Butler this evening. Fledgling has just been released, along with a new edition of Bloodchild that includes two heretofore unpublished, if you don't count the internet, stories called The Book of Martha and Amnesty. Ms. Butler is currently on a tour crisscrossing the country promoting these two publications. When I spoke with her by telephone this past Sunday morning, she had just flown in from the East Coast and been awakened in the middle of the night by the airline delivering her luggage that had been left in Phoenix. The good news, I said to her, is that they didn't leave you in Phoenix. And she said, oh, don't even say that. 5 years ago, Octavia wrote a description of herself that is often quoted. She said, and I'd like to read it, it's very short. I'm a 53-year-old writer who can remember being a 10-year-old writer and who expects someday to be an 80-year-old writer. I'm also comfortably asocial, a hermit in the middle of Seattle, a pessimist if I'm not careful, a feminist, a black, a former Baptist, an oil and water combination of ambition, laziness, insecurity, certainty, and drive. Many of you here probably already know the broad outlines of Octavia's life and work, that she was born and raised in Pasadena by her hardworking mother, who was a maid, and her grandmother. Her father died when she was a baby. That when she was 12, she was watching a, in her word, god-awful movie on television about Martians arriving on Earth and thought, geez, I can write a better story than that. That in 1969, she went to Cal State, LA, and took a class with the famous science fiction author Harlan Ellison. As readers and critics, we attempt to label and categorize her fiction, but it actually defies categorization and breaks the rules. All kinds of people are dedicated fans of her work. She has won the prestigious Hugo and Nebula Sci-Fi Awards, both of them twice, and in 1995 was awarded a coveted $295,000 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. That's one of those don't call us, we'll call you reward for creative people who push the boundaries of their fields. Octavia Butler is, without a doubt, one of the most creative imaginations, most creative beings on the planet. Last month, speaking at Stanford University, she remarked, I generally let my mind go where it wants to. I said to myself, I do that too when I'm supposed to be meditating or focusing on my work, but I don't end up with results like hers. The last thing I'd like to say by way of introduction is this. Looking over the body of Octavia Butler's work, I'm struck by her consistent attention to both what is wrong with us and the societies we create as human beings, but also what is potentially right and glorious about us. She debunks the idea that utopias are possible and says that nothing, nothing at all, would make us human beings more tolerant and peaceful. However, I personally believe that she hasn't given up on the species and has worlds to show and tell us about love, connection, community, healing, and transformation. Please join me in welcoming Octavia Butler.
Thank you so much.
So did I say anything in that introduction that you want to take issue with, comment on, argue with me about, amend?
Actually, there is only one thing that, for the sake of another person, I need to correct. I don't know that Harlem ever taught at Cal State LA.
Oh, wrong place.
He taught with the Writers Guild of America West. These classes that they were giving for the price that all new authors are happy about, they were free. And they were, I don't know, in the buildings that could be found that would allow us to, we were allowed to use them on Saturdays and hope to become writers in them. And Harlan was just one of the several teachers who joined, who became our teachers and who gave us the kind of criticism we needed, which we didn't really want it, you understand, but we needed it.
Yeah. I'd like to start off by asking you to fill in the 7-year gap between publishing Parable of the Talents and Fledgling. Why that much space? What was happening with you during that time?
Oh, well, I was having a miserable time with writer's block. Some of you probably think writer's block is when people can't write. Truth is, writer's block is when you're writing like mad and it's garbage. And there I was, writing like mad and trying to get something decent together. I wanted to write a book, a novel, that was a follow-up to the two parable books. And for many reasons, I guess, it just wasn't ready, and I couldn't do it. Then I wanted to try writing other novels. Came up with several ideas. Writer's block isn't even when you don't have an idea, or at least for me it isn't. Mm-hmm. It's when you express the ideas that you have so badly that there's not much point. So I did the best I could trying to put something together, and all I wound up doing was the two short stories that you mentioned.
Okay.
These were Amnesty and The Book of Martha. And The Book of Martha was a fantasy that I had a really good time writing. I had not been writing outright fantasies. I'd written science fiction. I'd written, actually, straight fiction. For instance, Parable of the Sower is pretty much straight fiction, but because it takes place a little bit in the future, it got called science fiction.
Actually, could you, what is your understanding of why you hit that period where you just couldn't write as you wanted to, what pulled you out of it?
There were several reasons. Yeah, I had some health problems, and the medicines I was taking for them were depressants. So, you know, I'm taking 8 different depressants, and I mean, I'm lucky if I can wake up in the morning. And also, I just wasn't really ready with this the trickster book, which is what I call it. It wasn't going to be Parable of the Trickster, but it was going to be either one book, 2 books, or 4 books. There is a verse in Parable of the Sower and in Parable of the Talents. Part of it says, God is trickster, teacher, chaos, clay.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write either one book in which I used most of that or all of that, or 2 books in which I got I would have used two of the words in each title, or 4 books, which I think would have been a lot of fun, even though I haven't done it. The Book of the Trickster, The Book of the Teacher, The Book of Chaos, and The Book of Clay.
Oh, my goodness.
So I have no idea whether any of these will be coming out.
Wow.
I still want to write 1 or 4 or whatever it turns out to be. But I couldn't do it then, and I haven't been able to do it so far, unfortunately.
Wow. So do you think that now that you've done fledgling, you may carry yourself through the agony of trying to go back to Trickster and trying to see
That's
if you can...
That's a horrible way of putting it.
Well...
Carry myself through the agony.
I don't wish you agony, don't get me wrong. But just listening to you talk, it sounds like, you know, you did try. Do you know what I'm saying? And or I guess a more positive way to ask that would be, do you think you're going to feel like you can go back to it and it won't be agony?
I really don't know.
You can't
tell. Really don't know. No, I was kidding. Some of it was agonizing.
Okay.
But I have no idea. What I know that when I was finally getting around to writing Fledgling, it was a matter of belonging to way too many book clubs. Many of us do, in one way or another. Now, these are not the good kinds of book clubs where people, you know, get together with their friends once a month and discuss the book they've been reading. This is the bad kind of book club where people send back the postcard.
Right.
And if they don't send it back in time, they get some book they never really wanted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I didn't get the card back in time, or I wrote the wrong number on it,
mm-hmm.
or something. But anyway, I got a vampire novel back in the mail.
Okay.
And I'm looking at it and thinking, well, what's this? And I opened it, which was a mistake, I suppose, and started to read. And I wound up reading the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, usually if I don't like a book, if I think it's poorly written, which it was, I won't finish it.
Mm-hmm.
But I finished it, and I thought, well, why did I do that? And I went off to the library and bought an armload of paperback vampire novels, found that they could be any of a lot of things. They could be history novels. They could be mysteries. They could be romances. They could be humor.
Mm-hmm.
They could be science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that with so much room,
mm-hmm.
maybe I could do something. Maybe I could find a way to write a novel in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I began to try. And I found that I did not want to write about a supernatural vampire who could give people the disease of vampirism by biting them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really kind of curious, and I compared it in my mind to, gee, you know, what if black people could bite white people and turn them into black people? Very strange, very strange. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it not a supernatural vampire, but a kind of science fiction vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who is a vampire because she is of another species.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't really have a choice about it, but she does have, for instance, venom in her saliva, so that when she does bite someone, they enjoy the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And are perfectly willing to have it happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, she is a very long-lived person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's going to live about 500 years. So the fact that she's 53
mm-hmm.
means that she's a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a baby boomer. You know, we're getting into our 50s and getting toward our 60s now. And I just thought it would be fun to be a kid again
mm-hmm.
and still be the age we are.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she is someone who is having to remake herself.
Mm-hmm.
She has amnesia because she's been so badly treated, wounded, burned, beaten,
mm-hmm.
and also shot.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have any idea who she is
mm-hmm.
or why she's where she finds herself or what she should do. So she's got 53 years of life there, and it's not serving her at all because she can't recall it. So I think starting again
mm-hmm.
is one of the things that we think about every now and then and actually do. And can I kind of bring you into this?
You're doing great. But, of course, while I was listening to you, I was thinking about the parallel with your seven-year break in the block.
Mm-hmm.
And so beginning again, writing Fledgling, was like a new start for you in a completely new direction.
Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, you sound as though you're beginning again yourself.
Oh, well, I am. And when you're talking about baby boomers, if we want to just get personal, I was wondering why you chose that 53, because I'm thinking about baby boomers, yourself, myself being in that age range.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually older than that.
But I am too.
If you write a little essay, you know, you can stay whatever age you claim
forever. Exactly. But I also heard you use that word fun. Mm-hmm. And I remember when you were at Stanford, I was there, you kept talking about how much fun it was to write that book. And I can tell you that when I picked it up, I was in this period where everything I picked up was boring me. I was having this horrible problem because I would pick up books and I couldn't finish them, which was totally unlike me because I was an English major. So any book I picked up, I had to read from start to finish. But I couldn't even read them. And then when I picked up Fledgling, that book just brought me into it. I just loved it. I'm reading it. I'm going, kick butt, Shuri, kick butt, you know, and I'm just totally fascinated by what you're doing with the characters, by how you're using the sexuality, just what you're doing with all of it. So when you said it was fun, I guess that's kind of a way of saying it was also pleasurable to read. And so it's making me wonder what you meant when you said it was fun for you to do it.
Pretty much the same. I had not been having fun at all with all those years of writing badly.
Well, no.
And writing the two parable books wasn't exactly fun either. Mm-hmm. I needed to write them, mm-hmm. but I had some things to say in them that were not wonderful. I mean, the idea was that they would be cautionary tales. They were, if we keep behaving as we have been, we're going to wind up in a very bad place. And here's a look at one of the bad places we can end up. Mm-hmm. If we keep, for instance, ignoring things like global warming, if we keep, and the weather changing, and I actually have a situation in Parable of the Sower, I believe, where there is a thoroughly nasty hurricane that hits New Orleans and does a lot of harm. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, prophecy. But, I mean, anybody who was paying attention could have written the same thing because this was obvious to anyone who wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. Interesting who didn't. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm.
Yes.
But also the idea, for instance, of being more willing to spend money on prisons than on schools and libraries. Mm-hmm. There was a lot mm-hmm. going on back in the 90s when I wrote these books mm-hmm. that seemed to me real foolishness. How could we not look and see what we were doing? Yeah. Well, a lot of us did look, but mm-hmm. I guess not enough of us. Mm-hmm. So there I was writing these things and mm-hmm. also some things going on in my own life. My mother died and one or two other things. Mm. And I wasn't exactly having a wonderful time writing those two novels. I wasn't having a horrible time. It just wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. But when I began to write Fledgling, it was my first effort at a fantasy in a way. Novel that wasn't really trying to say we should be doing this or that, but was saying, let's enjoy, let's have fun with this.
Do you know what?
Hmm?
I mean, I hear you. I totally hear you. And my experience reading the book would corroborate that. But as I think about it and as I thought about it, as much fun as Fledgling is, I think I can still see in this book that you are dealing with some of those things. Maybe
I couldn't really keep politics completely.
Thank you.
Out.
Thank you very much. And it's not necessarily, well, like in Parable of the Talents, we can look at that and we can see real clearly that it's about the rise of fundamentalism and, you know, a kind of like proto-neo-fascist kind of regime, and we can look and go, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And so I could, you know, we can see that as the warning stuff. But even if you don't think about that, when you look at fledgling, you can see all of these things that are, I think, what we expect to see. I don't know, expect is not the right word, but what's been a part of your vision, mm-hmm. that you're talking about, how can difference mm-hmm. coexist?
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about the need for symbiosis mm-hmm. and some kind of mutuality so that it's not just the vampire where I bite you, you die. But what happens if I bite you and we both live? Mm-hmm. How do we do that?
And not only that, we have a relationship.
And we have a relationship. You've always been concerned about making relationships. Mm-hmm. You've been concerned about family. You've been concerned about
community.
You've been concerned about a world that's non-racist, non-sexist, non-heterosexual. So all of those things, mm-hmm. even though this is supposed to be it is fun. Mm-hmm. I see those same kind
of... Part of that is, I mean, here I'm able to write about someone who had those things and can have them again. So in that sense, it was fun, too. You said something earlier that I don't really agree with. I didn't think to catch it. But, I mean, it's not that it's wrong, necessarily. I just don't really agree with it.
Okay.
You said, I didn't feel that anything could be done about our tendency to be intolerant of difference.
And not peaceful.
In the introduction, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I do feel that things can be done. It's just that they tend to be distractions as opposed to... healing.
You mean like real fundamental shifts in human nature?
No,
that's what you don't think is possible?
Not unless we're really going to go after each other with the genetic changes and all that, and that would be very scary, because we don't really know how, after all.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know what else we might do. It's after taking all the medicines that I'm taking, I'm very much aware of side effects. And it scares me to think that we will ever begin to tamper with ourselves in any permanent way.
Okay, now the reason why I said that, it was this essay that you wrote for the UN Conference on Racism,
mm-hmm.
where the question was, is there any way,
mm-hmm.
you thought, for people to be tolerant and peaceful? And you said, what could be done? And you did say nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I was thinking about.
Oh, I
about.
See. Yeah, but, I mean, we can't change ourselves physiologically to make ourselves more tolerant, but we can distract ourselves. And there are probably a lot of ways, but the one I came up with in the two parable books was this huge distraction of
going
to the stars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people have a religion that says, the religion is called Earthseed. And what they believe is the destiny of Earthseed is to take root among the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And this means that they have a religious mandate to do something incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible. I think the reason that that attracted me was I grew up during the baby boom, during the space race. That's what I meant to say. The other is true too. But the space race, I think, was one of the ways we avoided having that nuclear war. We had lots of wars, but we didn't have that nuclear war that we seem to keep threatening to have. We did find ways to compete, though. We competed in the ways that wars help us compete. Technological advancement, just plain contending with each other. You know, it's like a race. Who's going to get there first? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we didn't do much afterward, but at least we didn't have that nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be interesting if we could manage to distract ourselves with something. I mean, I've come to realize more and more what a really good tool distraction is, because George Bush uses it so very well. Hey, it works.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's, I think it's, well, I mean, I guess we gotta have something, but I just think it still is interesting that when you think about what can be done, that where you go is, I don't think we can do anything but take their minds off doing even worse things, mm-hmm. which I don't think is exactly the most optimistic.
One of the reasons why education is so important. One of the things I complained about most passionately, I think, in Parable of the Talents, mm-hmm. is our inattention to education. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's easier to distract people who who have a lot of things to think about, who have a lot of possibilities, mm-hmm. you know, people who are not sitting there saying, well, we can't do anything, or, well, I guess I can't do anything about this, you know.
Right.
It's odd that should be the case, but I think it is. How do you feel?
Well, yeah, what I keep thinking, now all of that's true, but when I look at your books, I see a lot of elements that do, in fact, tell us ways that we can be with each other and live on this earth that are positive, harmonious. They may not be what you would call utopic or utopian, but for instance, in the parable books, there you have Olamina. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the leader of that earth seed belief system, and she is able to hold a whole community together with that. She's able to do good. People, at the end, when it becomes the worldwide, you know, thing
one,
that
one
it is.
One of the worldwide religions.
One of the worldwide religions. She's the leader. Nobody says, well, we're not going to believe this because this is a black woman who's espousing it. They go to the stars. But, you know, and then even when you look at the Ina, the vampire community in Fledgling, you can see principles of cooperation. You can see principles of decency. You can see. You see what I'm saying? So,
well, my problem with that, and this is the maybe the pessimist peeking out, but my problem with that is, if it depends on one person, say Tito, then when he dies, when Olamina dies, people are liable to go their own ways. And it wouldn't be that shocking if some of them said to themselves, oh, hey, now she's gone. We can take over this organization and make some money or do some real damage or whatever it is that they want to do. So it scares me when too much depends on one person because everybody's mortal.
Okay, so when we read that book, are we as readers to think that all of those people who have bought into it, have subscribed to it, who believed in it, who've been changed by it, that that's not going to hold for them in any kind of ongoing way, and that it really is just about Olamina?
No,
because see, I don't read it like that.
Not that it's just about her, but that people can be distracted and will be, because the moment she's gone, there are going to be people who say, ooh, my turn.
Right.
Human nature has not changed in these books. And that's one of the reasons why she wants to, if possible, get them off Earth. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write about some of the people who leave, because I wanted to see what they were going to do, what the religion, for instance, mm-hmm. would do to them, mm-hmm. and what they would do with it. Mm-hmm. They have not changed. What they have done, though, is acquired a whole new set of problems by going to a new world. And it's just possible that these problems will hold them together in a way that will prevent them being really homicidal for a while. On the other hand, maybe not.
I think we're just going to have to say you do have a dim view of us.
I think no, I think human beings can do a great deal, but I think that it doesn't take very many human beings to distract us in ways that are truly horrible. For instance, imagine a country in which there is gold and diamonds and all sorts of goodies, and there's a leader who's been around for a while, and he's a tottery old man, and there's some young guys who are looking at the gold and the diamonds and the beautiful women and all the things that they don't have right now because the tottery old leader has it.
Okay.
And guess what's going to happen? You know.
Well, that's what happened in Pattern Master.
Well, that's what happens over and over again in the world.
Yeah.
I heard a radio, not really a show, but a bit of NPR this morning. They were talking about what's going to happen when Castro dies.
Right.
Scary.
Right. Right. Well, that's scary in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
in terms of not only what the young men are going to do,
but
what's going to happen.
America is going to do.
What everybody else is going to do.
And what people who've been located here are
exactly.
going to do.
Exactly.
And everybody will feel that they're doing the right thing
yeah.
in some way.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll even be right, but I'll bet you they'll still kill quite a few people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what else comes into this conversation is that new story, The Book of Martha,
mm-hmm.
Which you call as close as you've ever tried to write to a utopian
mm-hmm.
novel, where Martha is transported to wherever God is, and she sees God as whatever she chooses to see him as. First, he's this
gigantic
yeah. white man sitting on the throne like Michelangelo's Moses
mm-hmm.
or somebody, and then she sees him as a black man, and then finally she sees him as a black woman like herself, and it's just what she's able to see, and so you talk about that. But anyway, God gives her the problem of changing one thing about human nature. If there's one thing you could change about human nature, one change you could make,
mm-hmm.
what would it be?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you had that
really
author.
It's not changing human nature.
No, not changing human nature. If you could make one change.
Mm-hmm.
Make
mm-hmm.
one change. That's how it's put. If you could make one change. So I saw you wrestling with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just thought, she's working that again. What could be done? What could we do?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can we say what Martha ended up doing?
No,
don't
let's
say
not.
What Martha ended
no,
up doing.
let's just say that Martha is in her way successful. And God does put a restriction on Martha. God says, whatever change you make, whatever you do to human society, you get to occupy the lowest rung. So it's a huge example of you cut the cake and you get first choice of pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So my only effort at writing a utopia, and Martha does find a way to create a kind of utopia. I have always felt that utopias don't work, because, of course, if it's my utopia, it could be your hell.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case,
Martha,
maybe not.
Martha was in
maybe
hell
not.
Trying to come up with something.
Mm-hmm.
She was in sheer hell trying to come up with
because Martha
what
actually
would it be?
Cared, right.
Yeah. What would it be? And I think the one thing that made her try it at all is that she knew God said, you're going to do it. But she also knew that if she didn't, he could pick somebody who might really do something horrible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why she took it on. But it's an interesting thing where you went with that. So
mm-hmm.
we can't say that. Before we run out of time, can I ask you something about creativity and yourself as a writer and writing? I think I read somewhere that you said that when people ask you, what how to go about being writers, what to study. You tell them to study something like anthropology or sociology or something.
Or history. History is really
history is good. Yeah. Something where they're going to end up knowing the human species rather than studying how to arrange words.
Yeah, I don't mean that you shouldn't take creative writing classes. You should. But I think it's more important to learn more about people than to learn, as you said, how to arrange words.
Well, you said that.
Oh, my. Okay. It just seemed important to, especially with history, to know what people have been doing. It's surprising how many times we've gone round the same path, or not quite the same, but how many times we've made the same mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I actually, some of what I said about human beings comes from reading history. Mm-hmm. What we've done before that looks very familiar. Mm-hmm. When I wanted to come up with something, I wanted to understand better how countries went fascist when I was writing the Parable of the Talents. Mm-hmm. And so I reread Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which wasn't exactly fun. Mm-mm. But on the other hand, the first part of it really goes into detail about history, about how things were going on. And it's not simple, but it is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So do you believe in inspiration? Do you feel like when you write, you're really inspired, that there really is something
about... You probably wouldn't ask that if you didn't know already, right?
I don't think I know that.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I've read that. Because, you know, that whole idea that, well, in the book of Martha, you have Martha just eating up those moments when she's writing in a sweet frenzy and she forgets about the time and it's all night.
Oh, we all love those moments.
Exactly.
Yes. But we can't depend on them.
Yeah, but do you... So what... I actually don't know.
Well, I used to live next door to my landlady and I told everybody she inspired me. I think habit
this
is
not going to be a good story.
I think habit is a lot more... No, it's not a story. It's the truth. For 19 years, I lived next door to my landlady, and she didn't want to hear those stories. So I think habit is a lot more dependable than waiting for the inspiration to strike.
But do you think it strikes? Does it ever strike you?
Sure. Every now and then, you just get on a roll, and it's wonderful, but you can't depend on it. So, and you can't wait around for it, at least not if you're writing for a living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that anybody who wants to write for a living should even try to depend on. Mm-hmm. But when it comes, it's better than anything.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I just want to say what came in Fledgling, even though it was unexpected, is really, really wonderful. And do you have any idea where you're going to go next?
Oh, not really. I have a beginning for another Shorey book. I have, of course, beginnings for the Trickster book.
Yeah.
I actually have beginnings for other books that didn't get written during that 7-year period. So I don't know. To be honest, if anything I promised, it could be a lie.
Okay, well, my mother, who's going on 92 and in Shreveport, Louisiana, would say when somebody's asking her a question that she really doesn't know the answer to, she'll say, "Don't start me to lying." So we're just going to leave it at that and open it up so that the audience has a chance to ask you some questions.
Did you call in someone?
I forget her name, but she's walking around with the mic.
Hi, thanks for coming again to Los Angeles. Good to see you again here. But
my
question is, you know, in all of your books, I haven't read Fledgling yet, but in all of your books, a sense of place really the environment the characters are in from the beginning of your books to, you know, the parable books is so important. I was just curious whether moving to the Northwest from Los Angeles, whether that had any, you know, if that made any difference to your writing.
Well, I tried locating fledgling up there, so in that sense it did. And the Book of Martha is located up in Seattle. Probably you mean, has it affected my writing in any other way? Not yet. It probably will, but not yet. I was living over in Altadena and wanting to do something, to make a change, make a move. And I was invited to teach Clarion West back in 99. And it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened because I had been wanting to move to Seattle for a long time. And I was afraid to do it. I have friends in Seattle, but I have no family there. And I had never lived away from Southern California, where I do have family. So it scared the heck out of me. But on the other hand, when I thought about not doing it, it was so depressing. So I realized I needed to go. I think every now and then we need to go to the place that we choose as opposed to the place that we just happen to have been born.
Yes.
Thank you.
You talk about human nature.
I'm not sure I did, but go ahead.
Well, that's the word I heard.
And, okay.
I'm of the opinion that there's a lot of people that say human nature is evil. You know, the glass is half empty. It's not half full, but it's both. And I'm of the opinion that we live in a dog-eat-dog, rat-race world that forms human nature. And if we change society or if society changes for the better, human nature will change without genetic science.
I hope you're right. Well, one of the things I am is hopeful. I mean, in all honesty, I don't think you're right, but I hope you're right.
I think there was a hand right here. Okay, I'll get it to you. Right here.
I guess this is sort of a chicken and egg question. Your stories have so much exploration of both human nature as well as group dynamics. And I was wondering, when you come to a story, is it interesting to you because you've asked yourself a question and you get to explore sort of how that plays out in the human realm?
Sometimes.
Or is it the other way around? You've sort of come to a conclusion and so you tell the story because you've finally sort of cracked some element of what we are.
Actually, it's more likely to be the former. I ask myself a question or I challenge myself, as I did with the Book of Martha. And sometimes it's a matter of I've seen something that I thought was a needed comment, needed something said. For instance, the other short story, Amnesty, when I wrote it, what I was thinking about was a lot less popular than it is now. When I wrote Amnesty, I was thinking about the way we treat each other. The way, for instance, one person can be made a scapegoat for a lot of others who perhaps just happen to need one. How one person can lose all his human rights. I was thinking actually about what happened to Dr. Win Ho Lee. When the accusation of you know, you're a spy, you're betraying this country, destroyed his reputation, even though he wasn't. Accusation spread widely enough can do a lot of harm. My character in Amnesty is first captured by aliens who pretty much use her as a lab rat. And then eventually they let her go. And the aliens treated her badly because they didn't really know any better. She wasn't one of them. And there weren't a lot of choices for them. They were just trying to figure out what the heck she was. But when human beings catch her, they treat her very badly because they figure she must know secrets. And if she's not telling them the secrets that she learned after being captive for years and years, it means that she's sided with her captives. And she deserves to be treated badly. Well, of course she doesn't. I mean, the aliens are not sharing their secrets with their prisoners. So she gets treated worse by the human beings who catch her than by the aliens who had her first. And I've lost the train of why that's important to what you were saying.
I thought about something that I think would go along with the question that you asked. At one point, I think I heard you say, also that last time I heard you talk, that there are three sci-fi formulas. What if, mm-hmm. if only, if this goes on?
They're not exactly formulas. They're more like possibilities. And they're at the time someone came out with them, I think it was Robert A. Heinlein, but I'm not sure. They looked like the formulas, but there may be others now. Uh-huh. And this one was the amnesty was it doesn't really fit into any of them that well, but maybe it wasn't if this goes on, because locking people up and destroying their reputations has become a great deal more popular since I wrote that story.
Mm-hmm. And sure, and a fledgling would be a what if, right?
Fledgling is, yes, a what-if story. Most fantasy is kind of
a what-if.
Yeah.
And then Parable of the Talents.
These are If This Goes On novels, the two of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. This.
Mm-hmm. Can you recommend a book that you like that reflects what you feel about human nature? And also, can you recommend any good storytelling books, like How to Tell Stories Well?
Goodness. No, I can't recommend a book that, I mean, there may be some, but I haven't read them. I've read some that don't reflect my views, but I'd have to say, no, I haven't read one, and I haven't written it yet either, so there's that. There are a great many stories, a great many books on how to tell stories. A favorite old one of mine, one that I tend to go back to when I am feeling as though I've lost my way. It wasn't really written for fiction writers. It was written for dramatists. And it's The Art of Dramatic Writing by Lajos Igri. There are a lot more modern ones. There are a lot of good books out there. This is a great place to just go and investigate the books on writing, which is what I did from the time I realized that there was some possibility of my being a writer. Actually, what I realized was, hey, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up. And I went to the library, and I found out what I could. And I guess the only other resource that I had was a copy of the Writer magazine that I found on a bus. You might also look at Writer's Digest. So there's a lot out there.
There are many African societies that have, how can I say, their focus is on astronomy and various stories about, you know, what happened in terms of like their creation, their beginning, that connects with the astronomy. And I wondered if you had ever thought of using, you know, some of those African societies to sort of like jump off into maybe, you know, a book, a story.
No, I haven't. Just because I don't know. It's never grabbed my interest. I mean, I've read a lot of mythology, ours and other people's, and I've read a lot of, I guess, just musings, possibilities. But it has to be something that stays with me. There has to be something that really influences me and won't let go. I call ideas like that positive obsessions. And I haven't been obsessing over that particular subject. So I guess in that sense, I do kind of, I look for inspiration. Mm. Doesn't mean I'm going to find it, but I look for it because actually I don't have to look that hard. I tend to find it in things that bother me, annoy me, make me angry, which is really terrible but true.
I wanted to thank you for Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. It had a major impact on me, and particularly the Earthseed philosophy. I actually wear it around my dog tag right here. Truth has changed, God has changed. I was wondering what informed Alamina's Earthseed philosophy in terms of ideology, spirituality, past and present.
You were wondering what? I'm sorry, I missed part of that.
What informed the Earthseed philosophy?
I wanted my character to be honest. She's not trying to get people to sign their property over to her. I wanted her to believe what she was saying, so it had to be sensible. I wanted her not to be crazy, no poison Kool-Aid. It was important that she come up with something that made sense. Earthseed isn't really complete enough to form a religion, and it's not comforting enough. When I was first being interviewed about the parable of the sower and talents, someone said, someone was interviewing me and said she thought Earthseed worked very well as a religion, and I said, it's not comforting enough, and she said, I don't need a religion that's comforting. And I said, that's probably because you're comfortable. But, and I wasn't laughing at her. Mm-hmm. It's just that I got to see how badly my mother and grandmother needed religion and the way they used it. I mean, it wasn't an intellectual need. It was an emotional need, and it was deep and desperate. So if you're not serving that need, as a religion, you're not really serving the people that you may be hoping to attract. I didn't really try to get into that because I wasn't trying to create a whole new religion. I was trying to give you a sketch that said, here are some of the things that are important to the character. I hope I was able to do that. But that's what I was up to. Okay, where's the lady with the...
Right there. Here I am.
Oh, yes.
Right here. I have one statement and then a question. And the statement is that, I'll start with that. I happen to be fortunate enough to be friends, personal friends, with a lot of African-American wonderful women writers who we all know and we've all read their books. And I just wanted you to know that whenever your name comes up, it just changes the room with everyone. Your name comes up and everyone has put you in a place where you so deserve to be in terms of your brilliance. And I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
They all feel that way about you.
Thank you.
And then my question is, I can't help but ask, being from Los Angeles, have you ever been approached about turning your book into a film?
That comes up every single
time. I know it does. I know. I had to ask it. I'm so sorry, but I really want to know.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I have, several of my books have been optioned. And an option just means that someone buys the exclusive right to try to make the deal for a certain period of time and come up with a movie, and all the money that it would take to make the movie. I have had Kindred done as a radio drama, but nothing has been done as a movie. Much has been optioned, but no. Well, the money is the big thing. I know one group of people in particular spent an awful lot of time and money, and it was clear that they were serious, but they just couldn't get the deal to work. When you think how much money it takes to make a movie, yeah.
Is there one of your books that you would most particularly like to see be a movie?
Well, I think there's one that I wouldn't like to see as a movie, even though my mother always said I was hard-headed, you know? Even though it might make an interesting one, and that's Wild Seed, because of the changes that the character has to go through, and either the character would have to keep changing, well, both characters would have to keep changing, or there would be a pretense of change. And either way, I don't see it working that well. Now, somebody's going to show me that I'm wrong someday.
I could see it. I could see it, because with all the things that people are able to do, they say, well, see, when Doro jumps bodies, what you'd have to see visually would be something that would be the body he jumps into, but something to indicate that it's still him
inside.
Probably
his voice.
His voice, but it would have to be more than his voice to work visually. So I can see them coming up with something that would do. Anyway,
probably.
I can see it.
Probably. I don't. Well, part of it is I'm not that visual in my imaginings. I have a kind of audio imagination. I remember, and this really dates me, but I remember enjoying radio dramas.
I did too.
And I still like them. I like good books on tape, just because it's so wonderful to have some, you know, lie back and have someone read me a story. As a matter of fact, that's my favorite way of getting to sleep when I travel like this. I take along books on tape. And I don't like to have headphones in, so they have little speakers, and it's on the other pillow, and I get to have someone read me to sleep every night.
Okay, but what book would you like to see made into a movie?
I think the one that people would choose would be Kindred. That's what the one they have chosen. Kindred has been optioned more than anything else. And if you want me to choose,
yeah,
no,
that's what
no,
I
no.
That's what I was going for.
No, I don't really have one. In spite of some things I've heard from other people, I have never seen a movie that was as good as the book. And I think it would be very hard to do. Not that it couldn't be done, but that it would be very hard. And I have I've had some very unpleasant opinions about some people's efforts.
Yes.
Scripts,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So it would probably be really hard to please me. I warn people that if a movie is ever made of any of my books, it won't be my movie.
Oh, yeah.
It will be someone else's movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's my book, though.
Hello. Since you've been described as a hermit, and this is a rare occasion for us to have an opportunity to talk to you and hear your thoughts on this, is this something you enjoy doing, or would you rather just be left alone to write the stories and let people draw whatever conclusions that they want?
Oh, you mean speaking now?
Right, this having to travel, speak?
I am a hermit in the sense that if I really enjoy being a member of the human species if I can spend about 90% of my time alone. It doesn't mean that I hate what I'm doing. It's just that, you know, I have to get away. I have to spend some time writing. So that's the way I am.
In that case, is that 10%
that 10% worthwhile to you to then have kind of interaction?
I think I would probably be very odd if I spent no time with my fellow humans.
One more question.
Will you take that person with her hand right there?
Can we make it two more?
Yeah, that person right there in the right there.
Her.
Uh-huh. That's what I mean, both of them.
I met you about 20 years ago. I heard you speak at the Pasadena Library, and ever since then, Kindred has been absolutely one of my all-time favorite books. I think of that book very often, and I don't even really like science fiction. I'm not a fan of it. But
Kindred
is
not science fiction.
No, I didn't feel that. Later, I didn't even think of that when I was reading it, but then they described you somewhere as a science fiction writer, and I said, how come I liked your book so much? But that book, I think, could make a wonderful movie because it was so beautiful. You had this idea of science fiction, but you put people back in another life to have an understanding, because so many times people will criticize other people's way of life, but they haven't been there. Mm-hmm. You haven't been there, you don't know what it is. And I think that was done masterfully, that book. It made a big impression on me. My favorite books. I get everybody to read it.
It can be done well, and it can be done badly. But either way, I probably won't have any say.
Most authors say they like to sign it away, and then they forget.
Yeah, I heard a speech from Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho, many years ago. He's been dead for quite a while. And I went to a talk he was giving, and he said, take the money and run. Works for me. Oh, yes.
First, I want to say that Wild Seed is absolutely my favorite book of all time. So thank you for that. It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask a question. As a writer, where or how does your story, where does it live when you're writing it? Is it a thing that is living of itself? Like when you go to sit down and write after not writing for a day or two, is the story there on the paper, or is it there in a place inside of wherever it is? And does it roll on its own, or do you create it along the way?
Well, that's sort of like going and looking at somebody's vegetable garden, all, you know, prolific with plants that, you know, are bearing fruit and everything, and saying, well, gee, did that just happen of itself? First, you get the idea, and then you work it out on paper. I don't always know what's going to happen, but sometimes writing about it, sometimes literally writing about it as opposed to writing the story, I find out what's going to happen. So, and also sometimes I'll know what's going to happen and it won't. Writing can be very frustrating. But there's no rule for me. As long as it works, I'm happy.
And I think we've been very happy to have you here with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your attention.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.